You are listening to a lecture by Dr. Julianne Funk, recorded on Wednesday, August 10th, 2016, at the Menno Simons Center in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the Pacific Center for Discipleship Association. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the board. For more information, please visit our website at pcda.bc.ca.
It's really nice to be here. It's really a pleasure to be in this space and my parents' church and whatever other identities this group has, trying to learn it a little bit along the way. I am at the moment, you might have seen on my biography, just to give you a little bit about myself, I'm at the moment teaching part-time at the University of Zurich. I live in Switzerland for the last 2 years. I teach a little bit there in the field of peace and conflict studies and the cross point with religion or faith. And I also part-time work in Bosnia. So that's what this topic will be about. And I bring a lot of the work that I do in Bosnia into my teaching in my classroom because I think that's far more interesting to my students than some of the theories, or just theories. I tend to work from practice to theory, not the other way around. And that's appealing to some people. So that's a little bit about myself. I want to talk to you a little bit today about, well, this is, for lack of a better title, Sowing Trust in Minefields, Faith-Based Peace and Reconciliation in Bosnia and Herzegovina. I've been involved in Bosnia for the last over a decade or so, and spent an intensive about 3 years there as a volunteer with the Brethren Volunteer Service, if you've heard of this group. It's kind of like MCC for the Church of the Brethren. But before that, I was doing my research about Bosnia for my master's degree and my PhD. So I started as a researcher and ended up as a volunteer, working with the same people I had been studying. That was my hope, was to learn something from them about how to actually work with them and not just research their topic. So that's just a little introduction, and I'll say more. So for those of you who don't know where Bosnia is, because it's a little place, this gives you a map. This is Europe, as you can probably figure out. And Bosnia sits down here in what is now called Southeastern Europe or the Western Balkans, take it or leave it. Once upon a time, they just called it the Balkans or Yugoslavia, so the country of Yugoslavia, which broke up in the 90s. And Bosnia is one of the 6-7 states that resulted from that breakup. And I can tell more about that if you want more information about that in the question and answer, but I don't want to spend too much time on that because that's quite complicated. But the basic information will come that I think is helpful to know about the ethnic side of the conflict. So please. This shows you up close Bosnia as it is today politically. This is a political map, so it shows you that Bosnia is divided in half, but not just down the middle, as you can see, but in a nice, complicated segment of 49% what they call Republika Srpska, or the Serbian Republic, which is different from the Republic of Serbia, which is the country of Serbia, and the Federation, which is shortened, the Federation, the Bosniak-Croat Federation. So essentially, the country was, as a result of the war, split in half, according to more or less ethnic, or they call them national divisions, between Serbs on the one side, the north and the southeast side is the Serbian Republic, a centralized state they like to call themselves, and the Bosniak-Croat Federation, which is a series of cantons, so very decentralized areas that are primarily inhabited by Bosniaks, which before the war were known as Muslims in a political sense, and Croats, who are typically Catholic. So you have a division, you have national / ethnic divisions based on religion, because otherwise the language is very similar, the racial background is very similar. This is the prime difference, is religion, although every kind of difference that one can make these days helps the cause of the nation. So language is now differentiated. Now we have Serbian, Croatian, and Bosnian languages, which are mutually understandable, but they're different languages, etc. And Sarajevo is the capital here, you see, which sits right on the line. And you have actually an East Sarajevo, believe it or not, although I think it's really more south, but part of Sarajevo that was made into the Serb part. That's just a basic look at the country. So the country is divided, whereas once upon a time it was not divided, but it was part of a bigger whole called Yugoslavia. You can go ahead and move on. So this is me, just to tell you a little bit about myself. This is above the city of Sarajevo, where I spent most of my time. Beautiful place. Difficult element is right behind me over here are the trenches from the war where the Serbs were Bosnian Serb army was shelling the city. The city existed for 3.5 years under siege. And my best friend, for example, lived through it, so I hear many stories from her about that experience from 1992 to 1995. Go ahead. Some of more of my experiences, just to see, tell you where I was, so it may help you with your questions. Most of my time in Bosnia have been with Muslims or Bosniaks, and I was welcomed, for example, into a Muslim mosque, and I spent my first year there worshiping with them. And this is an iftar, or the breaking of the fast during Ramadan at sunset, one of the ones that I participated in with a group of women, just to give you an impression. So my experience has been primarily with Muslims in Bosnia and hardly at all with Serbs, primarily because of where I lived, and also not so much with Croats or Catholics. And this is determined these days mostly by location, geographic location. Go ahead. I was also working for an organization called the Ecumenical Women's Initiative, which is actually in Croatia. But they're a women's fund for the whole region. And so this is part of my work. They do work for women, for women's rights, peace and reconciliation, and interfaith cooperation. And I was working mostly on a fellowship for women scholars who are publishing articles, doing research and publishing articles about their faith and peace work. Very powerful, small organization in the region. Go ahead. So, what happened in a tiny little nutshell? To make it necessary for people like me or anybody else who's local to do peace work in Bosnia. As you may have heard, the war in 1992 included a term called ethnic cleansing. That's where the word originated, actually, which meant clean. That's a translation from the local language, which literally means to clean away the other group, which is considered impure or not part of our group. And you can imagine how devastating that could be. And that cleansing could be physically removing people, to killing, to primarily also focusing on cultural landmarks. So the destruction of all cultural centers and mosques and churches, because those are the symbols of that group. Go ahead. So it was both an urban war in places like Sarajevo, where you had the siege. These are twin towers of Sarajevo, which burned. There was the main drag down the center of Sarajevo, which sits on a long valley. It was called Sniper's Alley because that was, since the military who had the city under siege were sitting on the mountains, that was the most exposed area. And people had to cross the city in order to get what they needed. So these people here are running, and you have to run across that space. Please go ahead. It was also a very rural war. Bosnia is known for being a very rural country, actually. There's, before the war, 4 million people living in Bosnia, most of them living in the countryside. A lot of burning of towns, razing of towns, and people moving. These are prisoners of war, but a lot of times people just fled as well. There were detention camps. For those of you who followed this in the news, this was a big shock because immediately people were reminded of the Second World War. The Serbs or others, not just Serbs, but in this particular case, this is Ternopolje, would call it, detention camps or just camps. They claimed that they were actually being well, that the people who were staying there were being kept well. So when these photos came out, it shocked the world and actually surprised a lot of people from the inside who thought that they were actually, it was not so bad. Go ahead. There's also well known about Bosnia is mass atrocities or mass violence and genocide. Genocide has been legally proven for the case of Srebrenica, which you may have heard of. One particular case where around 8,000 men and boys were killed, according to the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague. And this is one of the very many mass graves that they are exhuming all the time and finding those who have been killed, identifying with DNA testing those bodies and then burying them. So that's just a really brief overview, because in order to look at peace building, we need to understand a little bit about what happened. Why are people so much unable to be together again after living together for so many years? Why is the trust so devastated? So you can still see the everyday scars. This is in Sarajevo. Just everyday things, you still see the shelling on the buildings. Of course, people are trying to rebuild, but those kinds of things are not so important as buying food and things like that. So you do see that all the time. Another scar is the way that the country changed. So on the left, it's not so important that you understand what each of the colors means, but just to see how the colors are distributed. This is the three ethnic groups, and there's others. So for example, the yellow and these are places that are very mixed, before and after the war. So the one in the before shows all the municipalities according to, what does it say? Probably by predominance of ethnicity. And you can see it's quite mixed. It was very hard to say that there was any particular majority in the whole country. There is no majority in the country before the war. Very, very mixed. People living, if not side by side, then in a village with two sides of the village, a Serb side and a Muslim side, for example, in the case of my best friend. The Muslim side was, she was in the Muslim side, and the Serb side was just there down the road. So living side by side, in the cities, literally side by side neighbors. And after the war, the ethnic cleansing was pretty effective. You can see that the lines are drawn by nationality or ethnicity. And for the most part, people from the Serbs would live in the red parts or do live in the red parts. The green parts are predominantly Muslim. The blue parts are predominantly Croat or Catholic. And the yellow are mixed with Muslim or Bosniak and Croat. And this just solidified things. So for example, in Sarajevo these days, I haven't seen the census data yet on Sarajevo, but people say it's 95% Muslim in Sarajevo, 85 to 95% Muslim in Sarajevo. Whereas before, it's the capital, it was mixed. People simply have gone to where their ethnic groups are now. And that makes it really, really difficult to build peace, because there's a lot of fear of the other and the fear of crossing those lines that you see between the red and the other, and some of the other lines as well. For example, another scar of the war is two schools under one roof, which is a common phrase you hear in Bosnia, where the two ethnic groups live in one city. This is Travnik, and they have two different schools. So this is the Catholic Croat school, and this is the Muslim Bosniak school, which looks awful because they said that they're moving to a new one and they didn't want to fix this one up. But there's literally a fence here in the playground. So the children do not interact during the day. They live side by side in principle in the town, but they don't have school together. There's different curriculum for history, for religion, for language. Like, they're not being even taught the same thing. And they don't have interaction. That's not every single school, but that's a lot of them. And that's been very controversial, and they're trying to change it, but the international community is trying to change it, and people who want Bosnia to stay together. But there are many people who would like these separations to remain because of all the complications that would come with it. Another element you see is competing symbols from religion. Religion is the key element, again, when it comes to making a differentiation between you and me if we're both in Bosnia. So, for example, this is the town of Sanski Most. We're going to come back to that with some examples I'm going to give of peace building. This is the mosque, the main mosque in Sanski Most, and Sanski Most sits right on the edge of Republika Srpska. And this church on the left, in a tiny little village, is right across that border. And if you may notice, there are four minarets and there are four towers. And that's very intentional, I'm sure. Nobody has been able to confirm it for me, but it's kind of interesting that they both have four. And the mosque was first, and that's still being finished, that church in the picture. And it's very much a competition between symbols. And it's interesting also that these religious sites are coming up in places where either nobody lives to even go to these churches, oftentimes. So, for example, Aida, my best friend, who I've already referred to, her little village in the Serbian part of, now Serbian part of Bosnia, she doesn't live there anymore, they constructed a mosque and an Orthodox church, tiny little village. And we were talking about it. I was just there in July. And she said, yeah, there's an imam there, but there's no Muslims living here, so we're not really sure why. They just come probably for Ramadan, Bayram, the holiday, and that's it. Nobody else is going to go there. But there's a beautiful big mosque sitting there. And the same thing with the Orthodox Church. They build these. They spend a lot of money on these buildings because it's very important to show that we're here. We're here. You haven't wiped us out for either side. Meanwhile, the country really has major economic problems. So that's kind of an interesting observation. So the question is, for Bosnia, how to deal with the past. That's a big phrase in Bosnia, dealing with the past. How can that be done? How to deal with the fact that this war resulted in three losers and no winners, essentially. This is a picture from Srebrenica, 2011. It's not my picture, but I've spent quite a few years there. This event happens on the 10th of July and 11th of July, where the bodies that have been exhumed in this from the mass graves and identified, when enough of the remains have been identified, at least 50%, that the family can say, we want to bury it now. This year, there were 615. And there are 8,700 and some total that they are expecting will be buried there. So far, it's nearly 7,000. And if you deal with this every year, this funeral that happens on the 11th of July every year is a big event and has become the defining event for the Bosnian Muslim or Bosniak people. It is their story. This is their story. And every year, this becomes a deeper, deeper story that has fewer variations on it. And you hear fewer other stories, because Serbs were also killed in this story, but that's not part of the story. There are certain victims that are allowed in stories and certain not.
Coffins?
These are coffins. They're not properly coffins because they're not solid. This is the Muslim way of burying. There's a wooden platform that the bones are put on, and then a green sheet that goes over it. Yeah. And they're all buried on this one day every year, however many that year that were identified and that the families wish to bury. And the event is a bit like a circus, honestly. There's always political speeches made, and then there's the janaza, the funeral, the Muslim funeral, and it's all kind of mixed together. And it's very problematic for a lot of Bosnians that this all gets mixed together, the political angle. And then, for example, 2 years ago, I should say last year, was the 20th anniversary of this event, of the event of this massacre. And it was an enormous number of people. I think 60,000 people were there. And one of the Serb leaders came. This is always a big question because some Serbs deny this ever happened. And one of the Serbs leader came to express, I assume, his apology or some sense of reconciliation. And he was stoned by, as he walked through the cemetery, was stoned by some of the young men inside the cemetery. And at first I thought, well, this guy is offering his apologies. Why would they respond this way? And then I heard, well, just a week before, he had blocked the UN. He had, I should say, encouraged the Russian leaders to block the UN's resolution that this was a genocide. So the people in the cemetery, the Bosnian Muslims, didn't take his authenticity at all. They thought this was not an authentic move, and so they were reacting. It's a very controversial issue, Srebrenica, because it's the story. So this is a bit more of it. These are some of the things that I just find around in Bosnia. On the left top, beware of evil from someone you did good to. This is a plaque on a cemetery in a very small, in a village, where my friends... cousins were and family are buried. This is, I think, a scary warning to me. It's in a way very understandable to beware of others, but also very heartbreaking. I find this a heartbreaking reminder. And then the Srebrenica, as I already mentioned, this I think is in Sarajevo, don't forget Srebrenica. And then at this football game, this is coming from the fans, the Sarajevo football fans, never forget Srebrenica genocide, never forgive. And the question is, how does one remember without blocking also healing? And that's my question and my concern, this never forgive is hard. I, on the one hand, I understand, and on the other hand, it is discouraging. So to move into what's to be done, this looks a little bit complicated, but let me see if I can explain. To analyze in little peace. What's the situation now? It's 20 years later after this war. The situation in Bosnia, people say now, is worse than it was before the war began. Now, in what ways, we could discuss. But the point is, there's still no trust. So if we looked at, and this graph here is the one way to look at conflict styles, different ways of responding. You can respond to a conflict, in any kind of conflict, with avoidance. If you don't care about your goal very much, and you don't care about the relationship with the people people that you're there with, if you don't actually really care so much about anything that's going on in the conflict, you can just avoid it and walk away. You can be competitive and force your way through if you care very much about the goal but not at all really about the relationship. And for example, in Bosnia, the internal politics tend to work that way. A lot of politics generally tends to work that way. It doesn't have to. We seem to think it works that way. This forcing, like, I will get my way, I don't care. You can be accommodative if you care more about the relationship than you care about the actual goal that you're achieving. All of these are possible. None of them are bad or good. It just depends on your situation in the conflict. You can compromise, give a little, take a little, or you can try to be collaborative, or some people call this problem solving, where everybody should win, a win-win circumstance. And this is what we all want, especially in serious conflicts, like in Bosnia. And so the typical relations in internal, as I said, in internal politics in Bosnia is this competitive nature. It's very aggressive, it's very polarized. And the politicians are the bad guys. In Bosnia, the politicians are the bad guys. If anything goes wrong, it's the politicians' fault, always. So, and that does arise from corruption that is going on, and how decisions are made for either for national or just personal interests. Bosnian politicians make far more than any other, than your average, the average income, for example. And this involves religions, because religious institutions tend to get involved with the political parties, backing one or the other. And some religious leaders, the head of the Muslim community ran for president. He stopped being the head of the religious community, and he ran for president this last time around. And that's just seen as kind of normal. Not wished for, but normal. So that's the competitive style of conflict is typical for the politicians, so at the public level. But at the relationship level between in society, it tends to be, in my opinion, much more unavoiding. So inter-ethnic relations, people just avoid. And that's majorly because of the country's segregation at the moment. It's easy to avoid. So there's physical segregation, but there's also this emotional or psychological segregation because of the lack of trust. There's a moral distancing of the ordinary person from what's called politics, which is really a dirty word, because you don't want to be associated with this national agenda and this acting for your own interests. But the problem with that, of course, is that politics is all bad, and how does one achieve new and changes in the country, which I find is problematic. And there's also this passivity or this refusal to take responsibility. Like, it's not my fault, it's always somebody else's fault first. And it's hard to move forward with that avoiding. So if we just look at these couple little elements of how we can see, understand the conflict today in Bosnia, we can move on to the next. This is something I ask myself. So if I'm looking at the social side, I don't work in the political arena myself. I work with grassroots organizations and people on the ground and religious groups. So I look at the social conflict. If the social conflict is primarily an avoiding of each other and social groups, how to transform that? What are the needs? What needs to change? So I look at, if we're searching for this collaboration, which is up in the top right-hand corner of that graph, this win-win, then how could we change it? Well, physical segregation could move into encounter, where we meet each other, have these basic encounters where you're a human being, I'm a human being, even if you're from a different ethnic group than I am, human to human. To maybe change the emotional segregation or the low trust, to share personal stories of hurt and of suffering. If that can be done, if we can actually tell our stories of hurt without blaming the others necessarily, but just tell what happened to oneself, usually there's a capacity to understand, because we all know what it feels like to have pain and be hurt. But that's a very hard thing to facilitate without the blame game going on. That would be perhaps the most difficult. There needs to be a valuing and an advocating for needs. So there are a lot of needs happening, a lot of things that are lacking in the country, economically particularly. 66% of young people are unemployed. 40% of the whole country is unemployed. People just want to go away because they want to survive like the rest of us. So how can we value these needs? They get completely pushed to the side because the national needs become first in the politics. How to value those needs across groups or between groups? When I think about changing this moral distancing from politics, because those needs still exist. There needs to be dialogue by really looking at the issues that are at stake and talking about them. And that can be a point of connection between ethnic groups because the issues often, as I said, cross those boundaries. And as far as this passivity, how to take responsibility for one's own or one's group's attitudes and behavior. How to move from a passive stance to an active stance. If those are some of the needs, I want to move on to tell you, and this is the most important part of what I want to share, the people that I've met who are doing this. So I'm a peace builder and a peace scholar, but I try to partner with people on the ground who are doing this work. For me, they know much better than I know, and perhaps that's an Anabaptist perspective, it seems to be, this elicitive method of John Paul Lederach. They tend to know most what needs to be done in their own communities, far more than I know. So when I've gone in to be a volunteer, for example, I wanted to learn from them what's really needed here and how can I be part of that? In what way can I help? And as somebody who didn't speak Bosnian at the beginning, it wasn't so much facilitating dialogue as it was other things that required English, for example, communicating with donors and things like that. But anyway, I want to show you how they address some of these needs. So I'll present three different cases, go ahead, or three different people, and I hope I can get through all of that just to tell you a little bit. I should say in prelude that almost all of the people that I worked with were Muslims, as I mentioned, but there are some beautiful exceptions that I don't know as well, but who I think are really, I need to mention. One of them is Danka Zeric. Danka's from Herzegovina, so there's Bosnia and Herzegovina. Herzegovina is a region of Bosnia and Herzegovina, the western southern part. And Danka comes from a place called Livno, a town called Livno. She's a Croat and a Catholic. And she was a policewoman during the war, at the end of the war, and the police were in charge of welcoming the returnees, so the people who had been ethnically cleansed, welcoming them back. And that was rather touchy, because this area had been ethnically cleansed of Croats first, and then ethnically cleansed of Serbs second, so back and forth, right? And so she was in the winning party insofar as it was now a Croat, Livno is a Croat place. But the villages around this Croat town were ethnically Serb before. So these Serbs were coming back. And the police, the Croat police from Livno, were supposed to help welcome them right after the war. Problematic. So Danka was doing this and had really hard time, actually, with her police forces because she really wanted to welcome them, and that was seen as some sort of betrayal. Yes, they're supposed to do it, but she literally wanted to welcome them. She would bring to the women, she would symbolic blanket to show them that, other things as well, but a blanket was really important to show warmth. She, in this little town of Grahovo, or village of Grahovo, which was a place she focused, she knows everybody there because she literally went from one house to the other house, giving them what they needed and asking them what they needed, driving them the 70 kilometers to the nearest town to get the medicine they needed. You can kind of see in this picture, the houses are completely destroyed. They're moving back to this place that's just razed. And they have to make a go of it here if they want to stay. And so she eventually quit working with the police force because that was not effective enough and was blocking her more often than helping. She started her own organization to do this work, and she's amazing. She's one of the women that we supported from the Ecumenical Women's Initiative with our work, and we nominated her for a prize that she won as well. Just really doing amazing work. And she's rural, so nobody hears about her. So that's what she did at the beginning. Later she started providing livestock and helping with a lot of agricultural aspects because that's how most of Bosnia lives is subsistence farming, just making enough to live off of. So introducing animals into their lives again after this was destroyed was a massive help. And also, it doesn't say here, introducing them to women. So it was very much women's advocacy kind of work. Because in this society, traditional society, the men would own the animals, they would own everything. And so, and the grants that she was getting from donors was, no, that has to go to the women. So it was a big negotiation that would have to happen within the family of how to allow women to even own these animals. And she did it in a very beautiful way of just talking through it with them and finding ways to do it. To look a little bit at the faith-based aspect, Danka doesn't, unlike the other two that I'm going to present to you, the other two cases, Danka doesn't tend to talk about her Catholic faith as being something that she needs to make explicit in her work. But she did notice, she keeps it to herself, and she says, it's just what motivates me, but it doesn't have to, I don't have to force that upon the other person that they acknowledge that, which is understandable given the circumstances. But she said when she started this organization, she realized that there were problems inside, because it was a mixed inside, Serbs and Croats, inside this organization, and they weren't really always getting along. They would be really two separate groups. And she said, this is not okay. We're one organization. We need to work together. So she said, in order to build trust between us, she organized these visits to the religious sites, the important religious sites from both sides. So, for example, Medjugorje. You may have heard of Medjugorje, an important Catholic site in Bosnia. Well, it's questionable whether the Vatican accepts it, but where an appearance of Mary happened. And other places that I'm not as familiar with as Medjugorje. And they would speak with the priests in these places and have conversations with each other and learn what these faiths are really saying as opposed to the political messages that they'd heard. And she said it was really effective. She said it was amazing. When I heard Catholics asking the Serb priest questions, like keeping the conversation going long, long into the night at this visit, she said, I knew I had succeeded. I knew this is working now, because they trusted enough what the priest was saying to engage. So that's a little bit about Danka and what Danka's busy with. So she's got encounter, she's encouraging dialogue, some of the other needs that we have up there as well. The next two cases are people that I've worked with in depth, so I know a lot more about their work. Vahidin and Mevludin work in a place called Sanski Most. You saw the mosque. They're both imams, which means they've both been trained to lead prayers in the mosque, although that's not their main job. They are the two directors of an organization called the Center for Peacebuilding. And I was working with Vahidin back when there was nobody else working with him. I mean, I came to do research and to volunteer in 2009 for the summer. These are amazing people. I wish I could have them up here talk to you themselves. But they both went through experiences of suffering during the war Mevludin was in a camp, and Vahidin had to flee right before his whole village was razed and his family was killed. And they both had hate in their hearts, and they both wanted revenge. And they wanted nothing to do with Serbs, they just wanted them killed. And they both had major transformations of those opinions. And now they share their stories with the other people in their town who have the same feelings and try to help show them another path, a path to peace. Incredibly inspiring people. So, for example, some of the work that this organization does, it's constantly expanding, and every time I go to get some new pictures for my presentations, I'm always amazed what they're doing. I don't have even half the new things that they're up to on here. But the peace camps they organize are really worth mentioning. Every year, for a week, they bring youth from all over the country, and that really literally means every different canton and every different part, to come together and get to know each other. And they work intensively on nonviolent communication and nonviolent practices, how to do it and how to teach it. And they have really hard conversations by the end when they feel comfortable with each other. And those stories that we talked about of pain, they come out. And they realize that the other people from other groups that are sitting next to them have the same kinds of painful stories. And they hear the effects of what happened from their group on the others. And it's incredibly powerful things to hear. A lot of things that nobody could speak come up in these times. And they also have a capacity to envision new futures, because friendships get made that last. And this is the next generation. They can decide what they want with their country. They can start moving it in that direction. There's also a really impressive endeavor called the Interreligious Council. Vahidin was trying for the longest time, years, I think it took him 3 years, to get the religious leaders in this town to come together. It was a Protestant pastor, an Orthodox priest, a Catholic priest, and the head imam of the mosque that you saw. When he finally managed to get them to all sit together, they had a dialogue about what are the resources for peace in their own traditions. And they now do this quite often, have this dialogue in front of any group that wants to hear. But apparently, I just found this on Beverly Dean's Facebook page, they visited the town of Prijedor, which is the nearby town. I told you, it sits right on the border between Republika Srpska and the Federation. And Prijedor is the neighbor town. They're literally on the same river. And they were, before the war, always in interaction. Now they're cut off. I mean, not any practical way, but there's nothing. You don't see any wall. But they don't have contact. And Vahidin's goal, I know, has been to engage with this town more and more because it's the Serb versus the Muslim towns. They've now become, if not 100%, then 99% of their group. And this is, on the left, a tour of Prijedor with the religious leaders from Sanski Most. And I can't tell you more about it. I asked my friend Mabludin to tell me more with what was happening. But I know the goal was to have this interreligious council be both towns together. So I'm hoping that's where it's going. Go ahead. There's also an interfaith choir that started up a few years ago called Harmonia, and they do concerts all over the country, but especially important to do it with Prijedor and other areas that are not of their ethnicity. And a beautiful group iftar you can see down here. It gets bigger and bigger every year, where there's sponsors and everybody from the town and Prijedor and everywhere else that comes. I don't have the picture here, but of the Orthodox priest taking part, which just makes my heart warm. He's really involved. Everybody just comes together and has this meal to break the Ramadan fast. And it's just a good time of socializing and being and encountering each other. The last case study is Amra Panjo. Amra is a dear one to my heart. During my first year of working as a volunteer in Bosnia, I worked with Amra. She's a big thinker. She's challenging her people, her own people, working with her own people to step outside of their role as victim, like this Srebrenica story, among other things. One of her really impressive projects has been to create a manual, a book, a teacher's manual to train students in the students of Islamic education, so religious education, which exists in the public school, it's not outside, so confessional teaching inside the public school, to teach those teachers how to teach the peace dimension of Islam within the faith. So in other words, not to teach a divisive religion. The whole question of religion in the public school is a massive, controversial thing, but she says it's there, we have to do something about it. What can we do? So then she's gone around and trained over 1,000 teachers, which is most of the teachers of religious education, Islamic religious education, teaching them in this method and giving them her book, which I think is really impressive. This was Christmas Day or Christmas Eve, because of course that's not celebrated for Muslims. We were in the Mufti Luk, so the kind of like a diocese of Banja Luka, with the teachers of Islam there. And this is at an interfaith workshop where Amra was facilitating with Anna Rafai here. And the hosts were these two lovely women up in the top, the sister Cecilia from the Catholic Church, and I've forgotten her name on the right, Muslim woman. And they are partnering in an organization called Mosaic to do initiatives like this. So this was taking place in the Franciscan monastery, or Franciscan school, I can't remember which. Just a chance to meet together and to hear each other's voices and to do some really interesting exercises together to build trust, which you'll see at the very end, which may be already. Oh yeah, another thing about Amra. So Amra married a Serb in the first year of the war. Amra's a Muslim. And she said that it would be like someone marrying a Nazi in the beginning of the Second World War. You just don't do that. But she did it, and it was important for her, and it still is important to tell her children, who now grow up in the almost all-Muslim town of Sarajevo, that being mixed is a good thing, and trying to emphasize why, and making sure that they're engaged also with their Serb Orthodox side as much as she can do. She's very much a Muslim, so she also gives them that input. And I always see that as a beautiful aspect of taking the peace message home. So this is the last slide, learning how to trust again. I just want to tell you about this picture. This came from that interfaith workshop in the Franciscan school. There was an exercise where all of these women would have to stand on a carpet. They'd put a carpet, or you could have a rug or a blanket. Stand on this carpet, and they just all fit in. And the goal of the exercise is to turn the carpet completely over, but nobody can step off of it. So it's an exercise in touch, actually. It's very much about coming physically close to each other who are not of your ethnicity. And you can't tell here, but you have Muslims and Croats and Serbs all sitting on, standing on this carpet. I mean, who knows who they are, but it's a mixed group of people. And finding it fun, actually, in the process of experiencing this challenging task. And once, I mean, you know this, once you've touched somebody else and smiled and laughed with them, those barriers go down. And you can have a conversation later over coffee much, much easier than you would have done if you just came into this room and didn't know anyone. I found that a really effective exercise, but also really symbolic of what's happening in this country. They literally do need to turn the carpet over, and they need to do it together. And at this point, nobody wants to touch each other. There's this avoidance, and this is the opposite of avoidance, and the necessity of, and the capacity of building trust, which I just find so lovely in that image. So that's just an overview of what I'm doing, or what I want to showcase what the others are doing, and I'm happy to take questions on any sort of topic that relates.